Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Have you ever been to Germany?
I stopped by in Amsterdam on a choir trip.
That's not even Germany in any way.
You're totally right. Oh my God.
Have you ever been to Germany? Yes. Amsterdam was, the clogs were ablaze.
Oh, I'm such an awful American.
That's so funny. Yeah, that country, you know, Europe, it is my favorite country.
It's all the same.
Yeah.
No, I've never. That's obscene. I've never been to Germany.
Okay, have you, we should go. It's great.
Have you been? Have you taken the?
I have
taken the train there. I guess. Or do you fly?
I don't. I just walked. It's always just around the corner.
Dude, it's one of those. You gotta go across the water though. Do you get in like a pedal swan boat to get there?
Yeah, it's just like a puddle. Yeah, it's not exactly the channel. It's not that much. No, it's really that like it's overblown.
I mean, we've got a creek that runs through the middle of the of Denver, and you can just hop from one side to the other. It's like that.
Yeah,
right?
It's just like that.
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theater Happy Hour, your weekly podcast with liquor and Lieder.
That's another word you made up. That one doesn't exist.
It's not. It's a type of song, Tomic.
A type of song?
Yes, it is.
I'm glad you pronounced. I would have said Lieder, which is not how that's pronounced.
Lieder. No, Lieder. It's German.
Wow.
Coincidence?
Probably. What are you drinking today, Jimmy?
Beer.
I'm
drinking a Hefeweizen.
Ah, see, I'm drinking a Pabst Blue Ribbon. It's the champagne of beers.
I know what a PBR is, mate. I am acquainted with a PBR.
Are you a hipster at heart?
Damn right.
Did you know?
No, I'm just a cheapskate.
PBR every year wins the Denver Beer Convention category for like light beer, which is like PBR, really? Bud Light, Miller Lite, Coors. Yeah. Yeah, and PBR sweeps it every year. They've been winning blue.
It's not that bad.
They've been winning blue ribbons for a century now.
Yeah, I think it's pretty darn good. So it's beers all around in our stein. Why is that, Tommy? Why are we drinking from stein?
I'll answer your question with our quiz question, which was, Bob Dylan became aroused straight away by the raw intensity of the songs in this musical. What musical was that, Jimmy?
Der Drei Groschen Oper.
Oh, good job.
Otherwise known as, thank you.
The Threepenny Opera.
Though the shark's teeth may be lethal, still you see them white and red, but you won't see Mackie's flick knife, 'cause he slashed you and you're dead. Jenny Dipper was a stripper. Someone ripped her from ear to ear. Though the knife work was artistic, seems that Mackie was nowhere near. Someone's lying. by the telly with his children and his wife. It's a painting done in crimson. You could sign it, Mac the Knife. Arnie Goldstein was garroted for his cufflinks and a ring.
Well done for saying "thrut me."
Yay! Oh, I'm sure I'll mess it up as we go on.
Yeah. So yeah, that first contentious point of the night, "thrut me, threepenny." It doesn't matter over here in the U of K. We say
Thruppany?
Thruppany.
See,
yeah,
and
Thruppany bit.
I had never heard that pronunciation until we started doing research for this. This one has been outside of my bailiwick for a while. And in my mind, it was always called Threepenny. And when we were talking about this earlier, listeners, Jimmy said Thruppany Opera. And I was like, what? Have I been saying that wrong?
What is this true?
And like, I mispronounce stuff all the time, too. So I was like, oh, God, no. So both are acceptable. We're letting people know that
totally.
Both...
For you guys, you can say threepenny.
Okay.
I don't mind.
Because
it means
threepenny, right?
It does. It's a threepenny bit is like a threepence piece from the old timey money. a threepenny bit and a bob.
A bob. A bit and bob. Is that where that saying comes from?
Sure.
Because I have like whenever we would sort.
Yeah, no, that 100% must be
like sewing supplies, and it's like bits and bobs, and that makes sense.
Oh, that? No, that won't be.
Oh,
it.
No.
Maybe it is. Who knows?
Etymologists anyway. In the audience, let us know.
Exactly. So we're doing the Threepenny Opera.
Threepenny Opera.
By the way, I've got so much of. I'm going to bring out my German.
I'm real excited. I'm going to nod along and be like, that sounds right.
Yeah. I don't speak German,
uh-huh.
but I love seeing German words in a German accent. So today's the day.
I'm
going to
make
that.
You a t-shirt that says that.
Thank you. That may be a nightgown. that's quite a long quote. Or just a very small font. Anyway, so what is the Threepenny Opera? Well, come on, you're the newbie.
Oh, God. Okay. That's a great question.
Just let's go for plot.
Yeah. So Threepenny Opera centers, it very much acknowledges its existence as a theatrical piece. It is an opera, both in its existence and in its script. It centers around a character colloquially known as Mac the Knife, who's kind of a Jack the Ripper style character in old timey, downtrodden
Victorian
German England,
London.
It feels like Oliver Twist, but with more blood. And so he is a con man, murderer,
arsonist, rapist,
like the anti-hero villager. Of anti-heroes in a town filled with treachery and villainy. And it kind of follows his exploits and I would say his decline almost.
His decline, but also his ascension.
But also his eventual ascension.
Important.
Exactly. And his relationship with women.
Yeah, and all of many
women, all the women, basically.
Yeah, but I guess the key part of this is that actually, really, the plot doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean that's as Brent would say. This is what I found. So, like, I didn't listen to this very explicitly or watch it all the way through until doing research for this podcast, and it is dense and difficult to decipher this play.
Yes,
I will say straight off the bat.
And at no point. Well, we'll rattle through who did what and when and why. Mm-hmm. So it's written by Bertolt Brecht, music by Kurt Weill.
These are people you should know if you do theater, by the
exactly.
way.
Exactly. I mean, really.
Especially.
Maybe not Kurt Weill as much, but...
Definitely Brecht.
Definitely Brechty. Yeah. I mean, come on. We've all written an essay on Brecht.
If you haven't, it's coming.
Yeah. So they wrote it back in 1928. It opened in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not even Broadway. We're not West End. We're Berlin, guys.
We're pre-World War II Berlin at this point?
Yes. Yep. So this was... I talk about Weimar Germany and my obsession with it a lot. Mm-hmm. This is like news from the Rialto of Weimar Germany. This was Brecht being like, look at what is happening.
Yeah.
Here's this show, slams it down on your desk, and then what happens 2 minutes later? World War II. So, yeah, it opened as Der Dreigroschen Oper. I bet you people are going to be like, Jimmy, your accent's awful. I actually think it's all right.
Okay? I mean...
Der Dreigroschen Oper.
You could fool me.
Yeah. In 1928 in Berlin. Mm-hmm. It came over to the States, I think, not that long.
Not
after,
long after. It didn't do well. It only played like 13 or 14 performances.
Yep. So like next time it did really well was came over to Broadway. Hooray. Mm-hmm. In the 56. And starred Kurt Weill's wife, Lottie Lenya, who was also in the original,
production, yep.
Who we'll talk about a lot later because obsession. It's been revived a few times. It's sort of also had London productions. Mm-hmm. Most recently with Alan Cumming and Cyndi Lauper, yes. On Broadway. You may even be alive to have seen that on the Tony Awards.
Exactly. And it's very popular among college theater departments nowadays, I've found.
Exactly. It really is. Especially, I think, theater departments as opposed to musical. You know, yes. What I mean? If they're not used to doing musicals... Yeah. It's a lovely way in, which is fascinating.
We are diving into the deep end of like this is a musical you study. This is a musical with a lot to slog through.
Exactly. And I think the most recent kind of notable production was last summer, over here at the National, and it wasn't very good.
Womp womp.
One of the things I found very fascinating, first fascinating fact of the day. Uh-huh. It was the first show to be performed in Berlin after World War II.
What a perfect choice.
Right?
Yeah.
But apparently, you know, the cast was made up of prisoners of war, mm-hmm. You know, Jews who have survived and come out and been able to come back to Berlin. Yeah. The setting was rubble.
Yeah.
Because that's what you had to work with.
Yeah.
It's harrowing, but like you say, so apt.
Yeah. So we should...
In many, many ways.
We should do a quick refresher on Brecht and some of the, like, why this is called the Threepenny Opera.
Yes, exactly. Sit down, get your notepads out. We're going to be learning today, okay? Here's some education.
We talked about Brecht in relationship to Sweeney Todd, did we not?
We did. We definitely... Because in that sense of... Sweeney Todd has that within it.
Yes.
Like, there's something in there in Sweeney Todd. This idea of like a kind of a Greek, harking back to the. There's
this kind of Greek chorus. It's very epic, big theater. And then Brecht's thing. Oh, that's hard to say. Brecht's thing was.
You can't say Brecht. That's
Brecht.
Right. You
have to
say Brecht.
Yeah, no, that's not.
That's hard.
I don't have that diphthong.
Brecht.
Yeah, no. Brecht's
Brecht.
Thing. Yes. Was. Kind of this observational theater. We're not in representational theater. You're not like lifting up the fourth wall to peek into someone's real life. Like, you are at a play to watch people pretending to be people to tell you a story with a moral.
Exactly. It's for you. This is a place for you to learn and wake up.
Yeah.
And he was it's not even that he was passionate about it. He was adamant. Do you know what I mean? There was no two ways about it.
To the point where something described as Brechtian nowadays is referencing that. Like, he has an adjective named after him.
Exactly. He was growing up in Germany at this time of change. Mm-hmm. Came through World War One. Here he was living in Weimar Germany and seeing all of this overspending. The decline starts to happen.
Yeah, the seeds of what would become World War II.
Exactly. And he's seeing all this and, you know, very, very switched on. He was eventually became a communist, which is where Weill and him differ, because Weill
was more of a socialist.
Yeah, exactly. But Brecht was really, really passionate about kind of being for the people. Mm-hmm. And... really wanted to use theatre in his writing as a way to get people to waken up. So he really hated any sort of illusionary theatre.
Yeah.
He hated theatres themselves because
like the
buildings. They would just try and bash out all of the important grit mm-hmm. that he felt, was integral to it.
He was not an entertainer. He was an activist.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, what are your views on Brecht?
Studying him in theater history, I found it one of the most interesting parts of what was otherwise a very boring class. I think his style and his opinions about presentational theater have shaped a lot of our, like, postmodern theatrical existence. We would not be where we are today without Bertolt Brecht. In a lot of ways, without the Threepenny Opera, because this was one of his...
This is kind of his training ground, really. This is where it all kind of began.
It's where he got his voice out. So the concept, but why it's called the Threepenny Opera, or will you say it in German again?
Die Dreigroschen Oper.
So it is an opera for poor people. It is an opera that only costs 3 pennies and only looks like it costs 3 pennies and is about things that people who could only pay 3 pennies to see an opera might be interested in.
So Brecht hated what was going on at that time, like grand opera. And even, we'll talk about this in a little bit, sort of the Wagnerian operas, which were very everything all consumed together. Very beautiful,
opulent,
and dark. So, like, Tristan and Isolde is so schmaltzy. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's extremely beautiful, but it's very schmaltzy, and you do get brought into it.
Yeah.
You feel all this pathos for these characters. Right. And, you know, that's theatre.
Exactly. Right.
But not
Brecht's theatre. I mean, would...
Not Brecht's theatre.
Would you say... Exactly. This is where I don't know well enough, but would you say that Brecht thought that was not a story of the people? That was not a story of the people who were coming to see shows?
Yeah, well, he was just like, stop. He was just like, stop looking at all of this stuff that is taking you out of reality,
right,
because you're ignoring what is happening.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to get very close to the bone, I think, with this podcast because of, you know, the day to day.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of, I don't know, that kind of almost like a debate of, you know, you see it a lot in trends of theater where. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see things like Threepenny Opera come into the fold. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not as extreme as that, but, you know, stuff that's a bit more boundary pushing.
Right.
And then you'll see beautiful escapism, and you'll get your Grand Hotels, and you'll get your She Loves Me's.
Yeah. It's the eternal question.
You'll feel all cozy.
Exactly. It's the eternal question of do you go to the theater to escape from the real world or to put a magnifying glass upon the real world?
Yeah. Are you Bertolt Brecht? Are you, you know, Konstantin Stanislavski?
Exactly.
You have to be one.
Yes.
You can't be two.
Yes. Well, I would. That's a thesis waiting to happen.
Exactly. No, you totally can't be two because I would completely say I am.
You're welcome, late night theater majors who don't know what you're going to write for the paper that's due tomorrow.
Exactly. Feel free to reference us.
Cite us, please. Don't plagiarize.
Since that fine day, so many have gone by. Didn't last long. When I felt pregnant, it was festive for a day.
But then we thought it best to wash it all away.
The drunken doctor showed us what to do.
We took the mess and put it down the loo.
And for a while, a smile was rarely seen
around that knocking shop in bed.
Okay, so
what is
We're kind of starting to talk about it. So yeah, what is it?
What is it? This is a rough question. So it's called the Threepenny Opera, and we're 1928. Is this the earliest show we've talked about on the podcast?
It is. We've gone further than we've ever gone before.
We've gone further back than even Oklahoma. So
yeah,
that should signal something to you. This is before musical theater existed.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. But this isn't musical theater because nobody knows what musical theater is.
It's not. This was part of the, like, where Oklahoma solidified it. This is kind of some genesis of it. Does that seem accurate to say?
Yeah. I mean, I don't even think, I still think it's a completely different ballpark. Do you know what I mean? Because it didn't it barely scraped the surface in the States.
Right.
You know what I mean?
People right. People weren't like, oh, this new art form that's Falls. Come. They were like, get out of my
exactly.
theater.
Yeah, completely. They were Ziegfeld Follies up.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely fine with that.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, obviously, over in Germany, it's a different world.
Yeah.
It's a very, very different world.
Yeah.
And so other stuff was happening, and this is one of the things that's kind of bubbled to the surface. I think for this whole discussion that we make of this, you need to have in your head, this was made at a time when music theatre didn't exist.
Right.
And that's why Threepenny Opera is very, very different to anything else you will ever listen to or see.
Exactly, because it was something that was almost satirizing opera at the time.
Yeah.
And so
it completely was.
Right.
That's exactly
and
what
it so was. It is automatically then distancing itself in a lot of ways from the conventions of opera, but it's not like it's landing into musical theater because that bucket hadn't been invented.
Exactly. Kind of like we were saying before, Brecht wrote this as kind of a direct response to what was called sort of Wagnerian opera, who, and here's some more German coming.
Oh, I'm excited.
He produced this concept, or is a part of this concept, called Gesamtkunstwerk.
Okay, Gesundheit.
Thank you. Which was the idea of bringing all the disciplines together and combining them into this beautiful bubble of illusion.
Okay.
Right? So you had dance and you had music and soaring orchestras and beautiful lyric and beautiful story all combined together and you're in this dreamy bubble. People loved it.
Uh-huh.
You know, people were big, big, big into Wagner. But it was very much in his game. It wasn't pithy.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if you ever listen to Tristan and Isolde, it's not pithy.
Yeah.
It's very, very dark and very, very beautiful and heavy, but it's still, you know, you feel pathos and you go to get that cathartic release.
Exactly. And to,
do you know
to,
what I mean?
to experience a story, a thing, an art.
Yeah, exactly. To you know, not have to look at yourself
right.
to be like, oh, these people, do you know what I mean? You can go after it, but like,
nowadays it's turning on the soap opera or the Bachelor even. Like
it's the Bachelor. Exactly. It's our reality TV.
Yeah.
So, as a contrast to that, Bertolt Brecht developed something called Verfundungseffekt.
Uh-huh. You should say those both.
I don't think I said that right.
You should say those both next to each other so people can hear them.
So, Gesamtkunstwerk and Verfundungseffekt.
So, the
okay.
the G, because I'm not even going to try. The G one, that's Wagner opera, and the V one, that's Brechtian style.
Yes,
stuff.
Exactly. So, if you've done some, you know, Brecht, high school musical theater, high school theater studies, you'll have heard of Verfundungseffekt. But basically, that is the posh name for epic theater, basically.
That's the alienation effect, right?
It's the alienation effect, exactly.
That's how they listed it in my theater history textbook.
Yeah, uh-huh. And it is that idea of bringing you out of this illusionary bubble, is being able to look at yourself and think, well, what do I think? How do I feel about this?
Right.
And it's how do I, do you know what I mean? It's coming from you. And that's what Brecht tried to do at all stages.
Yeah.
And Threepenny Opera was completely his training round, really, for that.
As I always say, if this seems too Heidi for you or too, you know, inside theater for you, think of how you feel at the end of Act 1 of Sweeney Todd and at the end of Act 2 of Sweeney Todd. And that is very much this effect that Brecht is going for. You're observing this story that's happening.
Yeah. Because you really shouldn't leave Sweeney Todd being like, oh, beautiful.
Right, like, oh, they were so in love, I want to go bake someone into pies,
exactly.
Which I think more than anything is the biggest failing of the Tim Burton movie.
Right, I get completely.
But
completely. It was romanticized.
Exactly.
And it shouldn't
but
be.
We're
He's
in,
a mass murderer.
Exactly. Like, yeah. And so we are... It's not even that we're in that ballpark with Threepenny. This is like we're building the ballpark.
This is the start. This is it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, if you do know anything about Brecht, if you've heard bits, you'll know some of his techniques, and you'll have seen them played out in varying degrees in different productions. Because nowadays, I mean, very rarely do people put on a fully, you know, Verfundungseffekt production.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen one that I would consider to be, wow, okay, complete.
Right.
Ticked all the boxes there.
Exactly.
But people do pinch,
little bits and bobs. Anytime you've seen a narrator step out of the story and start describing what's happening, that's because Brecht exists, you know?
Exactly. I mean, in many ways, like, look at something like Into the Woods, for example. Yeah. You mentioned narrator. Like, look at Into the Woods. That is, a guy who's obviously addressing directly to the audience. Mm-hmm. Being like, hey, and then halfway through they completely break the fourth wall, right. And then the characters
they use it to tell the story, and they use it to, observe these characters doing this thing.
Exactly.
Don't sympathize with them.
Yes. Uh-huh. So that is, that's where the contemporary, illusionary bubble, the Gesamtkunstwerk, starts to work back in.
Yes.
So let's go through some of the techniques. I always think this is fun because it was, I'm hark back to high school days where it was like the checklist of I mentioned this and I mentioned this, yep. And I mentioned it. But, for example, so Brecht always liked to show, for example, any light source, mm-hmm. You saw where that was.
Yes. You knew where that was coming from. The lighting instruments through and through.
Exactly. Famously had one that was lit by car headlamps.
Yep.
That's one of the quote that he would always use. Things like signs.
Yes, he was very big on just having signs telling you what was happening or what was about to happening, or then in its own special way giving you some kind of minor commentary into the thing that's about to happen.
Yep, exactly. And actually, when we go on to talk a bit about sort of Brecht and song and how he uses that, mm-hmm. Remind me, because I'll tell a little bit more from the man himself.
Yeah,
I've got a little book.
Oh, that's adorable little book.
I know. It's red and small.
Already talked about narrators, but all throughout this opera, there are people coming in telling you the thing that's happening or the thing that's about to happen, just on and on and on.
And I guess one of the key parts of Throttney that you would then use in many other things is song. Yep. You use song. Yep. What play do you know, especially in those days where the characters would just break out into song?
Exactly.
And absolutely none. That's hugely alienating.
And this one we're not talking like, Maria sits down with the children and goes, "Now, children, here's how we sing." And then all of a sudden we're singing and like you've been eased into this. No, this one is like, da 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 da, here's the song. Like,
Exactly. And then the characters, it's the stage direction is face down stage, walk down stage and look at the audience.
Yeah, and sing the song to them. Yeah,
in front of the curtain.
Yeah,
this, you're not in the show.
We are not diegetic by any means.
Exactly. That was this alienation effect. So you could sit back, and you could start to study, and you could be like, okay, what's happening here?
Yeah,
who's doing what? Why are they doing it?
Yep.
How do I feel about it?
Yeah.
These were the things that Brecht was trying to do. And it's the thing I find really interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we'll probably talk about this a lot as we go through. But I'm very interested as to why Throttney opera is the one
that stuck around. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was the gateway to another one, which you may have seen stuff of. Mm-hmm. That was a question.
Maybe. What's it called?
So it's called The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahogany. I'm not going to say that in German because it's a bit longer.
That is not a name on my musical theater radar.
So it's this is where I'm a bit like, what are we doing?
Right.
What's going on here? Because it's an opera.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? And it's always classed as an opera.
Yeah.
Which is why it's never been eligible for, any old Tonys.
Because it's squarely in opera land.
Yeah, but very, very famous. I think it was 2006.
Okay.
There's a DVD of it. You can get it. And there's loads on YouTube, show notes and everything like that, of Audrey McDonald and Patti LuPone are in this.
Oh, wow.
A production of this. And the music is incredible. Now, what he had done, this is Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht again.
Okay.
It's the exact same partnership.
Yeah.
What they had done before Throttney Opera, them kind of getting to know each other and working together, they'd written a show called Kleine Mahogany, Little Mahogany, which is basically lots of different little songs from what would eventually become this show, right? So it's like, that was their idea. They did Throttney Opera, they bashed that out, and then they got on to completing...
They went back to their thing after they're like tiptoeing into the water. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's very similar themes.
Yeah.
Kind of capitalism and, using love as a commodity and all of these different things. And so to me, that's actually the pinnacle. That's the one that is the should be the exemplar of Violin Brecht.
But it's not the one that made it.
We've actually got the rough cut.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That everyone knows about.
I wonder, and this is, I'm spitballing here, but this is a concept I've had with just in musical theater in general, and I think is important to observe. I feel like there is, what's the best way to phrase this? With something like Threepenny, my mom can go see it. I love my mom dearly. And can get some of the references, but also enjoy it as a 100% surface level piece of art. And I think that actually speaks to Brecht and Weill's, like that's a failing of the show, right?
Yeah.
That you can get out of it and just like you can walk out the doors and just say, oh, what an interesting story about an evil man who I kind of sympathize with. And like you're not analyzing society and you're not thinking about like this awful world we live in, but you're like, oh, what fun tunes.
Exactly.
And I wonder if that has made it more of a success because it you can put the mask of accessibility on that kind of fact.
Yeah. I think what we should do is let's talk a bit more. Let's go into the meat of the show and we'll revisit that question at the end and we'll see if we can tease apart what's going on here.
This is intense.
I'm loving it. I'm having a great time. This is my, I'm in drama teacher mode. You should be. This is your job.
This is my, if I knew that, yeah. Yep. This is my job. I love it to death.
Feel free to bring me in as a guest lecturer.
Nein. Jedoch eines Tags, und der Tag, der war blau, da kam einer, der mich nicht bat. Und er hängte seinen Hut an den Nagel in meiner Kammer, und ich wusste nicht mehr, was ich tat. Und als er kein Geld hatte, und als er nicht nett war, und sein Kragen war auch am Sonntag nicht rein. Und als er nicht wusste, was sich bei einer Dame schickt, zu ihm sagte ich nicht nein. Da behielt ich meinen Kopf nicht oben und ich blieb nicht allgemein. Ach, es schien der Mond die ganze Nacht und es war das Boot am Ufer losgemacht.
So let's go.
Let's talk about
the show. Let's go for the music. We're this is a musical theater podcast. Let's talk about the musicals.
Music. Okay.
Okay. Do you like it?
That's a tough question.
Yeah.
Jimmy pitched this show to me saying you're going to hate it. Which the dear internet, never tell me what I'm going to think about a thing. I want to figure out for myself. It's not one that's going to go on my, mixtape.
Yeah.
You know? I love the song Mack the Knife, but not from this musical. I love the song Mack the Knife from Frank Sinatra and Bobby Darin and Ella Fitzgerald, which we absolutely should remember to put in the show notes because she forgets the words halfway through and it's amazing.
Exactly.
But that,
and Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, exactly. But if you've heard Mack the Knife sung by a jazz singer, you have not heard the song Mack the Knife from this show.
Exactly. You really, really haven't. And again, we'll talk about that. But really haven't.
You know, there is something, and I wonder if this is just tapping into some connection in my mind that hasn't fully crystallized. But there's an HBO-ish kind of made-for-TV adaptation of this one. That
not the 1928 film.
Not the black and white in German film.
Okay, cool.
The film is called Mack the Knife.
Yes, it's got Julie Walters.
It's got Julie Walters and a couple other people. It's not great. It's not good. It was a nice full representation of the whole thing for me to put on in the background. And I don't think this is a show that translates well to film, because that's not the point. It needs to be on stage. But the other thing I noticed was a lot of the... it felt very Gilbert and Sullivan. It felt very Pirates of Penzance. It felt very like a dark retelling of a Gilbert and Sullivan piece, which maybe speaks to Brecht and Weil's intent. Like there is an absurd ridiculousness to some of the stuff that's going on. And what I kept going back and forth between is, should I be feeling grossed out and disgusted by this, or should I be laughing at its absurdity? And it was difficult. It was difficult to get through. It's very, you know, they don't do the conventions of musical theater that I'm used to that make a piece of musical theater easy to listen to or watch don't exist in this. They don't do a good job of telegraphing characters' names. They don't do a good job of like telling you who is related to who and why that's important, or setting up the eventual conflict in like a foreshadowy kind of way. It's just kind of all over the place, in the same way that I think opera is, but I don't particularly like opera for that reason. It's not a very cohesive story. It's more like a semi-abstract painting. And so for there are bits and pieces of songs I enjoy. The tunes are catchy. I actually know Kurt Weill's music more than you might imagine. I love bits of The Firebrand of Florence, which is not a show anyone pulls out of their pocket anymore. I like some of his stuff. I think you can hear him getting his this is the birth of what became the musical theater sound, for better or for worse. It's the reason why Mack the Knife became a jazz standard when jazz standards started existing. Like, Weill tapped into something about music that was catchy and hip and new, and you can hear it in this. But on the whole, to answer your question, no, I don't think I enjoyed it.
Yeah. What I would say, and almost to all of your points, is I think that's the point.
I think so too. And like I felt that kind of metacognition throughout it. Like, I don't think I'm not supposed to leave this going like, oh, the shark bait has such, right? Like, you don't, this is not Hello Dolly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're supposed to leave feeling grossed out, chilled, and by chilled, I don't mean like chilled. I mean like...
You mean
chilled.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, gross out, chilled, and questioning. And you should be questioning everything.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that the last lines of the show are literally a unison chorus, being like, we don't know what's going on, and, you know, pursue injustice, but don't act too much on it. Like, right. It literally leaves you with this complete question mark in your head, as you then would go back and digest everything else.
Right.
But you know, like you say about the weird plot and the mismatched characters and everything like that, that is Verfem Dunseffekt. That is alienation because effect. You're not supposed to be getting to know these guys. You're not supposed to be able to track the development of Polly,
right?
Because it's not important.
Right.
What you're supposed to be seeing is, well, how is Polly being utilized?
Right.
You know what I mean, as a unit by her father, and you know, like,
and this,
like that.
I mean, as you said, this is why we don't see full on Brechtian productions nowadays. Is because I think we've come to like an artist's agreement that we have to trick audiences to a certain extent to enjoying our thing. Nowadays, for it to, because I think the world has geared more capitalistic at this point, and so you have to convince them to pay for it first before you can give them your message.
Exactly, which Brecht would have a field day with.
Exactly,
because it's so capital. Like, the theater is now, you know, run by Wall Street. It's a capitalist world, and I just don't understand. But hey, that's who are we to judge? It's our livelihood. So. I mean, so, right, so you said you like Mac the Knife.
I like Mac the Knife. I like some of Polly's songs. The other thing I always was always in the back of my mind, because I listened to a couple different recordings of this. It's the same way I felt when I read the English translation of Don Quixote. I was like, there are jokes and subtleties to this that I don't understand because I'm listening to a translation.
Exactly. Yeah, you're like, this isn't right.
I'm like, this surely. Is, like, you're trying, but this, I think, is more clever and interesting in its original German, and now you've chosen one of the like 16 meanings that this line has
so then it's
almost impossible to then even compare recordings of different productions because the translations are so vastly different, and then they're just completely rearranged. You can't keep them straight. Like, I can't tell you know what the one song that I noticed it with, it's the cannon song or the army song or it's got like 16 different names depending upon who translated it. And it's just like, that is an added barrier to comprehending and understanding the show.
Completely. Interesting about the cannon song. That was the one. So Lotilenia, has this kind of foreword, which I was thinking about maybe writing out, but I don't know if that's plagiarism.
You tell us a little bit about it right now, that it won't be plagiarism.
Okay, there's just loads of nice moments. I might write down some highlighted quotes. Okay. But this is her talking about the opening. Basically, it was disastrous.
Mm-hmm.
The Berlin opening. Everything went, like, literally everything went wrong. And it hadn't been an easy path either, because this was very new.
Yeah.
And the theater really took a chance on both of these guys. And kind of after the producer heard it, they were like, well, no, we won't be using any of this music. We'll go back. So it's based on The Beggar's Opera, which has some music in it as well.
Right.
They were like, well, we'll just go back and use that music. And they can't do anything about it. In the end, they obviously went and used the music. But so here we go. This is Lotilenia's words. So at no time, I won't do it in a German accent because that's rude. At no time in theatre history did a play draw near its opening in such an atmosphere of utter doom. Also, I think this has also been translated from German. Otherwise, you know, this isn't her first language.
Right.
So give her some juice. The word around Berlin was that Alf Richter, who's the producer, poor benighted amateur, was stuck with the Turkey of all time. The disasters multiplied. Carola Nieher, the ideal Polly, had rushed off to Davos to be with her dying husband Clavont, and she never came back. After frantic telephone calls, she was replaced by Roma Bahn. The actor who was to play Mr. Peachum, she can't remember his name. She's like, the actor who was to play Mr. Peachum, could it have been Peter Lorre? Who knows, Lottie? Who knows? Backed out. And Eric Ponto was brought from Dresden. Harold Paulson, or Mackie, from Operetta. And Rosa Valetti, or Mrs. Peachum, a popular star in the Berlin Cabaret, shouted constant protests all the way through. Valetti, and again, another little Lotilenia aside, of all people with her gamey repertory. Love it. Don't even know what that means, but love it. Screamed that she wouldn't sing those filthy words in the Ballad of Sexual Submissiveness. And on the last day of rehearsals, signed a contract with another producer, confident that she would be free within a week after it closed. Helen Weigel, Helen Weigel suddenly burst out with a startling idea for her brothel madam to play her legless a la Lon Chaney, pushing herself around a wheel platform, as suddenly she was stricken with appendicitis and had to be replaced. There's more, like, so much more.
Yeah.
That went on. This was the night before, like, all happened just before.
Yeah, people either were being pulled out or were doing their best to find their excuse to get out.
Exactly. And Lotilenia wasn't even in the program.
Yeah.
She was scared, and Cartvel really, because that was his wife.
Yeah.
And he went off. But there's a lovely little quote just to finish this off, at the end, where, so basically, the show went on. At the start, people weren't responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cannon Song came on, and suddenly they were riotous and they were with it.
Huh.
And they got it after Cannon Song. And the reviews weren't that bad. Some of them were, obviously. but it just caught fire.
Yeah.
As these things do.
Yeah.
So she says here, what would happen, because it was such a renowned opening night, people would always say to her, like, I was there. Mm-hmm. I saw it. I saw you. Uh-huh. You were great. And she says, even now, anybody who passed through the Berlin of that period and who comes backstage to see me at the Theatre de Lille in New York 28 years later feels compelled to cry, of course I was there on opening night. And though I remember that the Schiefbaudamm, which is the name of the theatre, had less than 800 seats, I nod. Why not, after all? Sometimes remembering all that madness, even to that blank space in the programme, I'm not even sure that I was there myself. Lotilenia. I love it. I just love her.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. So it was kind of doom.
Yeah.
But it was weirdly canon song.
Is the one that solidified it.
Was the first one.
Yeah.
And I kind of see why. Because it's the first kind of like, let's all sing together.
Well, it's,
here's a catchy chorus.
For me, like, it's one of the first ones. Like, it could be straight out of a Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah, completely.
Like,
completely.
If it was trying a little less hard to convince you that it was real.
Yeah.
It could be like, you know, the modern Major General sings with the Pirate King. Like,
yeah,
that,
totally,
it's the same
totally.
Kind of level of ridiculousness and, I don't know, reckless abandon going on.
Completely. And it would wake the audience up. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it would completely wake them up. So that, I think that would be a really good little fire in.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with the music of this. Well, not all of the music, but there's a lot of this which, you know, features into my favorite mm-hmm. music theater songs of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, Sea Robber Jenny.
Uh-huh.
Or Pirate Jenny.
Yes.
Isn't that great? Sea Robber.
Oh, is that? Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Sea Robber.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Sure.
I'm just going to say. I speak German. If not, then that's a weird coincidence. So Pirate Jenny and Barbara Song,
mm-hmm.
Which on the Broadway recording is literally sung by Bea Arthur.
Of course it is.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Of course. She's great. And she gets called a giraffe for fun. like Pirate Jenny in particular,
uh-huh.
like, again, if you're out there and you're auditioning and you want a song that you can sink your teeth into and act, it's perfect. It's incredible. It's this tortured song. Also very interesting, depending on the translation that you read, it will come at different points in the show.
Right.
Which is always very odd. Same as Barbara's song as well. It gets moved around and swapped by characters and things like that.
Yeah.
So on the Broadway recording, it's the character of Jenny that sings Pirate Jenny.
Uh-huh.
In the one that I've been in, and two of the translations that I've read, it's sung by Polly,
okay,
at her wedding to entertain Mackie's troupe.
It's so there. It's like a choose your own adventure.
Yeah, just choose your own adventure.
Musical.
Just pick it.
Like, who are it's
pick
someone?
It. But they both, you know, it's this Verfim Dunsafet. It doesn't actually matter who sings it.
Right.
You're not. This isn't character
right.
development.
It's the. It's
just important that it's sang.
It's important that it's sang. So it's the mm-hmm. the content and the feeling of the song much more than the line it draws through.
Exactly, because so basically the song is about this, I assume this girl called Jenny, who works in a hotel or an inn, and is kind of abused by all the patrons mm-hmm. because she's just a little girl. But there's a ship that comes into the harbour and blows down the city apart from this inn. And everyone's like, why is that still standing? And it's actually because she is the like chief or the captain or the, you know, the one that they answer to.
Mm-hmm.
And she eventually orders all the men to be killed. And it's about, you know, having power
right.
and being strong. But it's a complete dream song. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because both Polly and Jenny are big dreamers. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They want out of their situation
exactly.
that they're in for very different reasons.
Right.
So it works for both of them. It is just an incredible song. I just think it's perfect. I genuinely think it's perfect. And this actually harks back to Bob Dylan as well. This is one of the main songs
the
that got him.
He was so aroused.
Yeah, this is very arousing to Bob Dylan. So that's, I mean, it's one of my, we could kind of go on about them all, but we could be here for hours because I do have something to say about them all. If you want to chat about one in particular, guys, come and chat on Reddit and I'll be there.
Jimmy will be there for you with paragraphs.
I'm there already. I'm just writing them as we speak. I'm getting them set up. I really, really love it. And I know it's not, to me, it's not musical theatre.
Right. It's,
I wouldn't put it on my musical theatre mixtape, like exactly like, yeah, you say. Maybe Pyrotechnic, because I really love,
yeah,
it. But, you know, Third Threepenny Finale, I wouldn't put that on anyone's mixtape.
No.
But it's still a very important song.
Right.
Does its job.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Yeah. And you gentlemen can wipe off that laugh from your face. Every building and down is a flat one. Your whole stinking place will be down to the ground on a dish cheap hotel, standing up, saving sound. And you yell, why the hell's beer that one? And you yell, why the hell's beer that one? All the night through with the noise, and do you wonder who's the person lives up there? Then you see me stepping out into the morning, looking nice with a ribbon in my hair. And the ship, the Black Freighter, runs the flag at its masthead, and the cheering's the air. Swarming with men coming off of that ghosty freight.
Speaking of songs doing their job, hi Seg. Gebrauchsmusik.
Gesundheit.
Right? Can you at least say one of them? Say this
Gebrauchsmusik.
Yeah, that'll do. That was pretty good. Gebrauchsmusik.
I feel like I sound like the actors in Forbidden Broadway attempting to speak German when they parody Spring Awakening.
Yeah, exactly. That's fine. That's how you guys do it. Gebrauchsmusik. So this is Viles. We're now in Vile camp.
Yeah, what does Gebrauchsmusik mean?
So that is songs being used as a purpose,
okay,
which is something that Vile was... So, but as Brecht was passionate about Bertram Dunst effect and the alienation effect, Weill was passionate about
songs with a purpose. Music. And we're not even exactly talking like songs with a purpose in the show. We're talking about like songs with a purpose in life.
Yeah,
in existence.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, this is completely. It's like these songs will attack you, and you will learn from them.
Yeah.
And he did lots of very interesting things to do that, and one of the key thing was to make them sound difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
To
make them sound challenging.
I mean, you listen to a Kurt Vile song and it's not A, B, A, B, A, B, or like we got a couple verses and then a chorus. Like they are complex, interesting pieces of sung music, which I think,
yep.
Yeah, I don't know what I was going to say.
It will just use, he used lots of, you know, different instruments,
mm-hmm,
that weren't heard all that often.
Yeah.
And he wanted to make them jarring,
yeah,
so that you had to listen. You know, yeah, I mean, it was that you can't fall asleep to them.
Right. Well, it also goes against the conceit of a traditional operatic aria where like you're impressed of the vocal capabilities of the performer. Whereas in a Vile song,
exactly,
you have to listen to the words. It becomes a song about words and a song about a story and a song about like something you must comprehend as a human being.
Yeah. And like, I mean, the pair of them together, they kind of shirked rhyme. They weren't like, oh, here's a really good play on words.
Yeah.
Half the time the lines just don't rhyme.
Yep.
Or scan.
Yeah, at all. But
And that's fine because you hear it that way, because you're like, that
didn't work.
Right.
What did you say?
Yeah.
Why did you say that? Okay.
Yeah, it is not...
And it does
it's
jarring.
You can still tell it's intentional. It doesn't seem like a mistake or a lack of skill.
Exactly. I'm going to go back to the book. My little book. I love this book.
It's adorable. It looks like the Communist Manifesto.
So interesting. So this book, the reason I like it is because it's a translation I've never seen on a stage, on a cast recording, anywhere.
Huh.
I've literally never seen it. But one of the translators was Christopher Isherwood.
Okay.
Who wrote I Am a Camera.
Yeah.
Which is based in Cabaret. So I like it for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, there's something genuine about the style going on there.
He knows his stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? He knows his Weimar. This was written during Broadway. 1949.
Okay.
Pre-Broadway.
Okay.
Okay. It's pre-Broadway.
Post-war, pre-Broadway.
So I like, because it's very different, that's why I like
it.
Anyway, it's also got that foreword, and it's got these notes at the back from Brecht himself. Okay, so lesson from Brecht here. And he talks very explicitly, in the same way that, you know, and you get your MTI scores, you get notes from Pasek and Paul being like, hey guys, how's it going? Have a great time.
Measure 58, make sure you remember to,
Yeah, exactly. And just be, and it's like, you should really, really feel it. Brecht was like, this is how you do theater. All right?
Slaps you across the face.
Yeah, it literally comes with a slap.
Yeah, it's like, shut up and listen. Is that the name of the chapter? Shut up and listen?
Genuinely. So, for example, I'm making sure I'm finding the right one. One of the chapters is called, Why Must the Mounted Messenger Be Mounted?
It's a question and I ask question myself every night.
Exactly. on singing the songs, okay? When he sings, the actor accomplishes a change of function. Nothing is more detestable than when an actor gives the impression of not having noticed that he has left the ground of plain speech and is already singing. The three levels, plain speech, heightened speech, and singing, must always remain separate from one another, and never can heightened speech be an intensification of plain speech, nor singing of heightened speech. How'd you feel about that, Tom?
That's beautiful and is absolutely the antithesis of like contemporary musical theater advice.
Right. We might as well just shut down the podcast, right?
Like nowadays, can you imagine like a musical today that sells itself? It's like, we're having conversation. And now I am singing.
Exactly. Full stop.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Like the lights turn on the orchestra as they rise from the pit so you can see them. Like,
exactly.
Yeah,
big arrows pointing at the orchestra. The actor must not only sing, but show a man who is singing. He does not attempt so much to project the emotional content of his song.
Mm-hmm.
And he offers a great Brecht quote here. Can one offer others food which one has already eaten? And he's got a point. As to display gestures, he loved his gestures.
Yes, he did.
Can't remember the gestus. I think that's what it's called.
Gesundheit.
Come on, advanced our drama. As to gestures, which are, so to speak, the customs and usages of the body. To this end, he would do well when studying his part to use not the words of the text, but common current forms of speech which express similar meanings in the everyday idiom. So far as the melody is concerned, he need not follow it blindly. There is a way of speaking against the music, which can be very effective just because of an obstinate matter-of-factness, independent of and incorruptible by the music and rhythm. Also, Brecht really loved a long sentence. Just to let
that's
you know.
It's not even a sentence. That's just a bunch of words.
It's just a bunch of words. Basically, I think what you're saying there, especially about the music part, is don't stick to the melody because people are going to get lost in it.
Right.
And it's much more important that you can fire the words out. You know what I mean?
Which is so different from opera, from traditional...
Exactly. Where it is very rigid. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I love this. If he drops onto the melody, this must be an event. To emphasize this, the actor can show clearly his own delight in the melody. So it's literally, it's like, right, so you're singing what's written now. So look like you're really enjoying
look
it
like you're,
to show people
you're
that
really
you're not
excited
actually,
that this is the melody.
You're not meaning exactly. It's so fascinating.
Well,
it's a good thing for the actor. I'm on finish.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good thing for the actor if the musicians are visible during his recitation, and also good if he's allowed to make visible preparations for his recitation. For example, arranging a stool or making himself up. Particularly with a song, it is important that the actual process of performance should be visible as such.
That's Brecht.
I am Brecht and I have spoken.
That's true. That is Brecht 100%.
Exactly. Straight from the horse's mouth right there.
What I find so fascinating and interesting about it is those conventions, Brecht is very much attempting to use them to create a... to create that alienation, to create a seriousness or a disconnect or, you know, it's a very down feeling, whatever it is, around the art that he's making.
Yeah.
And I would say those exact strategies are used nowadays in contemporary musical theater solely to create comedy. Solely to take you out of the moment and make it like I think of, you know, near the beginning of Book of Mormon when whoever comes in to like, we're going to Africa, and like they do this whole like Lion King play, and then it's like, oh no, it's Mrs. Such and Such from down the block. Oh, y'all have a nice trip. And like there is something very Brechtian about that because it's like we're taking a break.
It's when Pizza Rat runs across the back of the stage in a transit.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Right. It's you know what I mean? Yeah. It literally is.
Exactly. It is like, we acknowledge that we are doing a show and that you understand that. Ha, 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 audience.
Exactly.
And it's not that, like, attend the tale of Sweeney Todd, you know, take this really seriously. Like, we, and I'm sure Brecht would hate it 100% that we are, you know, we have turned his strategies on him. But I think...
Completely.
Yeah. I don't know what I think.
It's I mean, he talks a lot again in this book. I might type some more bits out and put them in the show notes because it is.
What's
really, really
what's the book officially called if people are looking for it?
It's called The Threepenny Opera, Brecht by Peter Smith.
Oh, okay, does it have like a publishing year or something that people could?
1949.
Okay,
it's the Grove Press edition.
Okay.
Yep. It's got author's notes and Lotte Lynn. Yeah,
it's red.
It's small and red and hardback, and I found it. It's lovely. But I will write some bits out. Because like he does talk about an audience a lot, and he talks about what he wants an audience to be.
Right.
He wants his audience... For example, he never calls them an audience, he calls them spectators.
Right.
Because that's exactly what he wants it to be. He's very Greek about it, you know?
Yeah.
And he wants them to be smart.
Yeah.
And he wants them to be intellectual about it. So that they will get, you know what I mean, they will get something from. He doesn't want people to come in and enjoy themselves and escape. Do you know, that's
he wants them to come in and look at the life outside. It is interesting that he, you know, so much of Brecht's work and Weill's work is kind of breaking down the tradition of the opera. And I wonder, despite, you know, Threepenny did not have success on Broadway, but this idea was in the air. And I wonder if this kind of breakdown of the art form was necessary to give birth to the contemporary musical theater we know today.
I do completely think so, because if you think about what musical theater was born from, and I'm talking about Broadway American musical theater here, it was the Follies and these comedies, and people just wanted more.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They didn't really want to be patronized. They were ready to have actors and ready to have stories.
Story and plot and, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so in many ways, that kind of them pushing it away from these operas and kind of pushing out of that bubble.
Yeah.
And as well with Gilbert and Sullivan, because Gilbert and Sullivan were slightly mocking operas
yeah.
with their Savoy operas.
With much more of a lilt in their step, for sure, but...
Exactly. Like, they didn't hate opera. That wasn't their thing.
Right.
It's weird to think that Threepenny Opera paved the way to musical theater, and I don't think that's true.
I don't think so too, but I think there's something, it's why we're talking about it. It's why you find it so interesting. There is something here that appeals to our contemporary musical theater temperament.
Definitely. And what I think is interesting is this going to be a wave? Is it a, you know, like 100-year wave that we ride? Do you know what I mean? And in a, you know, a decade's time, are we going to start seeing people tearing the genre apart?
Yeah.
That, do you know what I mean?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, we've talked to no end about Great Comet, but that could very well be the beginning of it.
Is it? You know, that's the thing is like, is that what's happening?
Right.
And I'd be very interested to know, because the thing is, you know, Brecht was doing it and Weill as well. They were both doing it very utilitarianly.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they were Marxists, and I'm using a different philosophical term, but as in, I mean, they were using, you know, the form as a tool.
They had a purpose outside of the form.
Exactly. But I think for that ever to happen, the theatre would need to allow itself not to make money.
Right. Which in...
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is impossible.
Don't tell any lighting designer that at this point.
So do you know what I mean? So we almost need this almost sounds very bad. What I was about to say, because I was going to say we almost need another Treaty of Versailles kind of thing. Because what the Treaty of Versailles did was put all of these sanctions onto Germany, which is why it entered into this state of destitution and why people got extremely desperate and created these, you know, warped forms.
Yeah. Well, I think we forget how lucky we are that we live in a time where art is a job and not like a fundamental result of the need for human expression. And like that people do theaters because it's their people do theaters. God, people
do the theater. Yeah.
Actors exist, performers exist, that these people do this art because it's something they want to do and they can find financial stability doing it. Not because at our deepest, most human core, we are people who express ourselves and must find some form of outlet for that. God help us. And like, I do think it's a lie sometimes to say that good art only comes out of severe, severe hurt. But there was a lot of severe, severe hurt that made this kind of art.
And that's the thing is, it's not even necessarily good art. It's just different art.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that is, it was a genre.
An important art and encapsulated in a very particular way, a very particular time that just writing it all down wouldn't have been able to do.
Exactly. It couldn't have existed anywhere else and at any other time.
Ask your brother out to eat. He'll steal the shoes from off your feet and then he'll kick you in the face. Oh, don't you love the human race? Your wife will hang around your neck, but you ignore her for a sec. She'll kick you in another place. Oh, don't you love the human race? And think of all the things you did so you could educate your kids and then they shove it in your face. Oh, don't you love the human race? That everything's so hideous. We have to say what must be said. That life's a bomb and then you're dead. You must admit that life's a joke, a crock of shit, and then you croak. We should be high instead of low. But let's be practical, it isn't so. We should be good instead of base. But let's be practical, it's not the
case. We must admit that life's a joke, a crock of shit, and then you croak.
I'm glad we all see eye to eye that life's a bitch and then you die.
Yes, isn't it invidious that everything's so hideous? It's something which you can't deny that life's a bitch and then you die.
Let's tie all this up together. Okay. We started to get towards it last time. You know, about what is Threepenny Opera today? What is Threepenny Opera in general?
Do you perform Threepenny Opera today? How does this...
Yeah. Exactly. Can you ever perform it again? Do you know what I mean?
Should you perform it again?
Yeah, exactly. Because you'll be doing it wrong in some capacity.
Is Ben Platt going to be in it on Broadway in 3 years?
Exactly. Are you going to be able to get Cyndi Lauper to draw in the numbers?
Right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are you? I don't think you are.
I don't think
you shouldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's, I mean, this is what we're talking about here. And this is something that I feel quite passionate about. And it's almost, we kind of broached on it when we talked about Hair. And that, like, you can never charge for production of Hair because it's for the poor people.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? It's for the hippies. It's for the people who are rejecting,
right,
you know, the mainstream, yes, and the capitalist.
Exactly.
this is the exact same thing.
Mm.
To charge like $200 a ticket to go see the Three Penny Opera.
Right, makes no sense.
Is very weird.
Yeah. Especially with such a purpose-written show.
Yeah. And so I think one of the things that I think has happened with this now, and I think it actually has happened with a lot of Brecht productions, mm-hmm. Is that it's not Brecht anymore. It's, let's do something fun here. What we can do is we can have the lights fly in,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can see them, and then we'll put this like weird cloth, and then people can like blah, 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 jump around, and they'll change characters like halfway through.
Yeah.
Let's do that. And I feel like they're like, that's Brecht.
Yeah. There's
it's not.
There's like it's like being a vegan who wears a leather belt.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you that he would hate that what you would do. Do you exactly. know what I mean? Because you're trying to dress all this up in order to get a show
right.
that fits as a show. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is an enjoyable, fun experience.
Right. But he never set out to write a show. This was
that isn't what he wanted.
This was never exactly. It was never a piece of entertainment. This was never intended on its most deepest analysis to be a piece of entertainment.
Exactly. And I feel so the most recent production, this National Theatre production, I feel exactly was that. For example, like Peachum was kind of dressed in drag.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Peachum was dressed as Anita Berber, who is a sort of Weimar icon.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make any sense in its own right at all. The numbers that they did were fine and Brechtian in the sense that they were isolated.
Right.
But it was still, you know, you would leave from that being like, that was nice. You know what I mean? Right. You would think like, oh, that was good
what
fun.
What a fun night at the theater, which is not the point. Oh,
Peachum was a drag. Yeah. Wasn't that funny? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You're not leaving thinking, I hate capitalist right. society and yeah. we need to do something about this.
But so then I think this is where I think this is a catch-22 wrapped inside of a catch-22. Is like, in today's professional theatrical environment, you can never adequately do Threepenny Opera. Because to pay the artists the wage you think they deserve, which I think they absolutely do, you're already not doing it right, you know.
Yeah.
But you're also not going to convince 50 people who do this kind of thing well to come together to do your like maybe slightly communist manifesto piece for free because it's a play of the people.
Exactly.
Like, people don't care about this play that much. But then that's where it's a catch-22 wrapped in a catch-22, because I think it's important that people listen to this show and its existence is remembered, and we keep doing the thing where it pops up every couple years and someone does a production, but then you can never do the production accurately.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like it's all summed up if you listen to Mack the Knife sung by Frank Sinatra or Bobby Darin
yep.
or anyone. They're singing about a mass murderer,
yep.
right? And it's swung and it's an enjoyable experience and you'd rapturously applaud at the end and you go home going, oh, the shark head. Oh, ba-da-ba. Do you know what I mean? He would be rolling in his grave.
Yeah.
But then I also wonder, would he?
Right.
Because it makes people know what the hell Threepenny Opera
like,
is.
Has it actually served its purpose? There's something very Black Mirror about that, of like, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, people singing about a mass murder.
Of like Violent Brecht's like, song written with a purpose suddenly becoming this pop hit. It's really, of the songs to become popular, I think it's the best one too. Because it is just about the plot and is one of the most gently insidious ones. You know, it's not like, and then he raped me and we died. Which is some of
the, well, it depends on the translation you read, admittedly.
I guess that's true. And then who, what jazz singers put in their new spin on it.
Exactly. It was written, again, it was one of these things that all happened right before the show, because the guy who's playing Mackie was like, I don't have enough.
Right.
I need a number.
I need another song. It was,
people need to know who I am.
Yeah. Just to appease the star. And then that's the one that made it out.
Exactly. It's fascinating. It's a completely fascinating show. This is like of everything that we will ever do, nothing will come close to the kind of conversations and things that we can have when we talk about Courtney Opera.
Yeah, this is why it's such a popular college show. This is why it's in theater history textbooks.
Exactly.
Because you can talk about it from every perspective until the cows come home.
Exactly. Exactly. We've barely talked about what it's about and the morals and, you know, actually what the hell, you know, Brecht was trying to do with it.
Although I will,
so that's something you,
I will say to our credit, I think Brecht would be pleased that we haven't put too much of our own judgment on some of the morals and the content, because this is a show best experienced. This is
exactly, that's exactly it. I would seek out a production no matter how amateur, because it's you can, even if you close your eyes, you can still hear the lines being delivered, and there's no getting around it. They're very explicit.
Yes. There is no bolderized version of this show. You cannot do a censored version of this show. It's just nothing. Thanks. So, I mean, like, next time you listen to Frank Sinatra or Bobby Darin or whoever singing the quote-unquote jazz standard Mack the Knife, maybe it'll be a little more chilling.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. And someone sneaking round the corner.
So that was Threepenny Opera.
Threepenny
Opera. Der Groschen Opera. Zwei Groschen Opera.
So many translate. Pick your own translation.
Exactly.
I've got a quiz question for you, Jimmy.
Oh, yeah.
Are you excited?
I'm so excited.
I'm going to read you a primary source quote, and then you have to guess, well, not you, but the audience. You know how this works. What musical this quote is about.
Primary source, guys.
Straight from the horse's mouth.
How dare you?
Here's the quote. From the outside, I'm sure it sounded like all hell had broken loose in my dressing room, which, in fact, it had. I was hysterical. I took to batting practice in my dressing room with a floor lamp. I swung at everything in sight. Mirrors, wig stands, makeup, wardrobe furniture, everything. And then, I heaved a lamp out the second floor window.
That was beautifully read.
Thank you, thank you.
I must say, that was very well read.
I've been practicing for at least a minute.
Excellent. If you would like to get in touch with us, please do. You can find me over on Twitter at Asen Hendricks and YouTube at the same handle.
And I'm at Musical Mash on Twitter and Musical Theater Mash on YouTube. And our show Twitter is Jim and Tomic.
Or you can head on over to our website, jimandtomic.com, which has our link to our Reddit discussion where I will be going off on Threepenny Opera.
You can
please come and talk to me about it. Please. I'm so excited about this one to talk about. Please.
It's
please.
Absolutely, you should. It's the best place to have that kind of discussion. Tell your friends about this podcast.
Absolutely. And we shall see you next Wednesday.
Yes.
Promise.
That's dangerous. That's don't really
promise.
Dangerous.
I know. No, don't promise. I don't promise. I take it back.
We'll see you sometime.
Bye.
Bye. Gesundheit.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at supsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.